please help me welcome our speaker tonight. So we have Sean from Eye of the Storm Group in Milford, New Jersey.
Sean, alcoholic.
Hi, Sean.
If anyone's like me with severe ADD and is more happy with following the bee around than paying attention to me, I get it. I can relate. Thank Jeff for asking me. He asked me last week, you know, and I said, yes, that's what I do. And whether I feel like doing things or not. And I'll start, you know, like for over a decade, I had no idea what being an alcoholic was, and I had no idea what alcoholism was, and more importantly, I had no idea what untreated alcoholism looked like. And through my experience, I had to go through two different pains. Pains, one, of being completely drunk and high and wanting to be sober, and then the total opposite of being sober, living without a solution and wanting to die, because that's how painful things get. And that was the moment that I decided to take action. And because of this meeting specifically, it was very important to my sobriety. You know, my home group, which is Milford, Thursday night, 7:30, same format. We reformatted it to match this about 5 years ago. And I was lucky to be a part of that during that transition. And because of Alcoholics Anonymous, the 12 steps, sponsorship, and more importantly, God reliance, not sponsorship reliance, I was given freedom. And that's what we're able to have here, is freedom. And for anyone that basically has been in prison their entire life in their mind, to get that freedom, that feeling is so overwhelming that the things that you wrote off in life, the things that you thought weren't going to be possible again, became possible. And I can't be more grateful than to have a understanding of my God and, more importantly, having relationships with others these days. And I mentioned Jeff. Jeff is the funny-looking guy with the glasses. We call him Squirrel. He's a home group member here. And he had no idea what he was doing 10 years ago, 10 plus years ago, was going to not just impact my life, but give me the ability to be a father again, to be a son to my parents, a brother to my sister. And that's what, you know, we get so ingrained into, you know, what we're doing early on, that we don't really get to see how this is going to unfold and impact others, you know. And because he went through the pain and struggle 10 plus years ago, and he was just like me, seconds and inches of not coming back. And he took action, and that action was passed on to another person, Steve Eastwood, who's my sponsor, who passed it on to me. And now it's my responsibility to carry this message wherever and whenever possible. And, you know, quick background. You know, I grew up, I have the two most loving family parents that you could ever have. You know, my mom is a retired ICU nurse of 45 plus years. She has dedicated her life to serving others. She exudes love as naturally as the sun comes up. I can't explain it any other way. Like, she just wakes up and she just thinks, how can I make my children's, my grandkids' life better? And then, you know, I have my father who was always there to make us happy, and he was always there to encourage us to pursue whatever we wanted, and he was there to back us no matter how stupid it sounded. And, you know, he was always there to give us that emotional support. And I am the only one in my family, the extended family, that has this thing. And when things came out that I am an alcoholic, and they had no idea what was in store for them, and really, frankly, neither did I. And the pain that we do put others through, the things that we don't really see in the beginning, I drove my parents to that line that they almost hated that they loved me so much, that they could not love me enough to help me out anymore. And I had to drive them to that line where basically they had to take that position. And I remember calling from rehab in 2013. I remember calling them and saying, I'm good. Like, I'm good to come home, and things are really looking up, and I'm eating, I'm exercising, all the normal things that we say to manipulate, to get back into a situation that we feel comfortable in. And, you know, my dad said, you ain't coming home. Like, you can't stay here. And that was the first time I ever heard my dad take the other approach that wasn't, yes, I'll come get you immediately. And some of the things that the outside circumstances that really deliver and pound that internal demise, that demoralization that we do feel, there were several moments like that in that time I could feel chunks of me being taken away. And one of the biggest things, you know, I've gone to 6 rehabs, countless IOP programs, PHP programs. I've had counselors, psychiatrists, psychologists, arrested 2 times, and I got divorced, and the time away from my daughter started to affect me. Because I wasn't ready to be a father when I had her, and, you know, basically, I looked at her as somebody that was in my way, that the money was no longer going towards me, and that the money was going towards her, time was going towards her. And luckily, with the new perspective that we're granted through the steps and through this program, I can look at it and see that she didn't deserve this. She didn't want to get born into this thing that her father had. And we split time with her, and one of the most heart-wrenching things that I remember is she was supposed to spend time with me on a weekend, and my ex knew I was messing up. And she called me and said, I'm sick of telling her all the goddamn time that she can't go see her father. She's going to grow up to resent me because I keep telling her no, and she doesn't understand. So guess what? You're going to tell her. So, yeah. Okay, and I got down there, and she came around the corner. She was 3 years old, and she had her backpack packed. She had her stuffed animal with her. She had her hair in a ponytail, and she came around the corner all happy, and my ex just sat there and was waiting for it to unfold, and I was like, all right, you know, hey, babe, sorry, you can't spend the weekend with Dad. She did the most typical thing a 3-year-old does, which is, why, Dad? And I couldn't really say much to her. I just said, it's just because it can't happen this weekend. Maybe next weekend or something. And she asked again, why? And I did what a alcoholic does, and I yelled at her, and because I didn't know how to handle my emotions. And off she went, screaming into her room, crying, and I saw her heartbreak right in front of me. You know what I mean? Like, it really just tore right in front of me. And then there was other instances. You know, my sister was the only one during that time period that pulled an intervention on me. And she came over to my house, and she said things like, if you don't go to choose to get help or piss in this cup, then you are no longer going to see your nieces, you're no longer welcomed in my house, and I'm not going to talk to you. I told her to get out, get out. And she left, and I didn't talk to her for years. Didn't see her kids for years. Then, as the story unfolds, some of this internal stuff that started happening was, is like, I never sat out or sat on this course of demise that I wanted to bring people with me. I just thought the whole time if everyone just understood how I felt, then they would probably understand my actions, and that's normal, you know. And I got to a point of my life where I could no longer function in the morning throughout the day. I would plan out things in my phone, how I'm going to wean down off of this thing and be able to detox myself. And it would be like a three-week plan. It would be all jotted down in the calendar, and I would sit there and I'd say, oh, no, there's a family thing in like 2 weeks. Like, that's not going to work. I can't do that. And then I tried to put a timer in my phone, which was I wanted to go 6 hours during the day. Not right when I woke up. When I woke up, I needed what I needed, and then 6 hours later, I was going to see where I was going to reevaluate my situation and see if I can hold on longer. And I remember checking my phone and being like, oh, it's got to be like 3 hours. And it was only an hour. It was an hour. And I held on for like 40 more minutes. And that basically was at the point where I didn't want to do what I was doing anymore. And some of the safety that we destroy in our families that we don't understand that we do. My father, I was trying to get out the door one day, and he said, can I talk to you for a second? I said, why? I got to go. And in my head, I knew what was going on. My dealer said he was available, and when he's available, I'm available, and we're going to make this happen. So I got to go. And he said, wherever you're off to, just sit your ass down in the chair. And I said, all right, well, I can't be long. And he said, you never can be long anymore. And he said, one of the most influential things that really started to tear at my heart, which was, just to let you know, when you leave the house at night, your mom sits at the door crying because she doesn't know if you're going to come home. And we've come to terms that you're going to die, and we're going to try to raise your daughter the best that we possibly can and try to answer her questions, which most likely will be, did my daddy love alcohol and drugs more than he loved me? And it got me thinking, this whole thing that I'm experiencing, which was somewhere along the line in my life, I made a decision that I wasn't good enough. Like I wasn't whole, that there was this thing missing. And I had no idea what it was coming into AA. And I had no idea. And frankly, I didn't really care anymore. And but wow, that would have messed her up, right? Like, she would have just grown up to be like, I guess I wasn't a good enough daughter for my dad. And that started to destroy me, things like that. And eventually, I got to that turning point that they say in the book, which was... And I'll go back to that second pain of experiencing sobriety without a solution. You know, about 2 years sober with a little AA, just a little, not much. More of the I'm just going to go to meetings and see what pans out here type of attitude. And I departed from AA, departed from doing all the things that we're supposed to be doing. And about 9 months later, I found myself in such a situation where I was in so much pain. I was in so much struggle. I was so exhausted. I was just a workaholic. I was paying my bills. I was trying to do all these things that I thought were going to benefit my life. And then to only get to a situation where my mind brings me back to that one instant that I will pick up no matter what. And that was the case. I had no defense against that situation. I started taking back roads home. I worked managing gyms over in this area, and I take back roads towards here, and then all of a sudden I'm on 78 for a couple weeks, and then all of a sudden I'm in the fast lane on 78 passing my exit, and I'm saying if I make it to Newark, New Jersey, then that's just the way it's going to go, I guess, you know. And looked at my phone, I was like, man, I should probably call Steve, because this is bad. And then I said, you know what, it's already decided. And 27 days of going back out I experienced the other part where was that I had a mind that could no longer process reality, and I had a body that could no longer take what I was doing to it. And I found myself down by the river near my home in Milford, New Jersey. It was a cold winter February day, and I remember sitting down there by the river, and I was like, I couldn't do this thing. I can't keep doing this thing the way I'm doing it. And like, my God, I can't, more importantly, I can't do this thing sober. Like, now I was in this, such a spot of desperation and like just stricken with fear that like I was shaking. And I just was in that mode of like, the best thing that I possibly could do right now is just take my life. Like, let's just do that, because like, that will end the suffering for myself, at least, you know, not thinking about the suffering that gets passed on to our family members. And in that moment, I cried out to something, like just a blood-curdling scream that I yelled out to something that I had no idea existed. I had no experience with spirituality. I had no experience with a God, and I haven't had that. So in that moment, you know, I screamed out, and it was like, I don't want to say it was like this, that white light experience, but it was enough that I realized I got to get out of this situation right now, like right now. And I went home, and I experienced the pain of looking at my father's eyes and telling him that I relapsed. And he knew and I knew that this wasn't one of the early times of like, well, let's just go get you help type of deal. This was a definitive thing that he looked at, that he's like, yeah, I thought he was going to die, but yeah, he is going to die. And luckily, I've had in those 2 years prior to that, that I had this experience with AA that some people were living a life that I couldn't deny. Like, I hated them. You know, I hated Jeff. I hated Steve. I hated Jeff's little goofy laugh. And like, it was so annoying. And you know, they broke down this language to me that I don't know if I was just so closed-minded, I didn't want to hear it, or where I was in that process. But what desperation gave to me before the pride and ego kicked back in months later was this willingness to just, whatever, like, oh my God, like, I'll just do whatever, I guess. And that whatever attitude really sparked a new experience. And my experience was step one, you know, being powerless. I understood that. There were days, there was, like I said, with the calendar and like that hope that's like, tomorrow's going to be different. Tomorrow, like, I'm going to do this. And like, by the weekend, I'm going to feel this way. I know that because of the detox process. 7 to 10 days, you're rotting in your bed. And then like 14 to 21 days, like, you got the post-acute withdrawal symptoms, and like, you get to work out and like, date new girls and like do all these other things. I knew that was the process. And then there was the day, the night that it was like, tomorrow is going to be different. And then the acceptance piece of, no, it's not. Let's just call this what this is. You're doing the same thing tomorrow, so let's not kid ourselves. And just accepting the fact that like, there is no hope anymore. And when I got around these guys in AA, they started talking about life's problems that were not centered around not drinking and not using. And I started to open my eyes to hear things, and the powerlessness part, I nailed that home, you know, but I never understood the unmanageability, right? Like, the unmanageability is that I can't manage my life sober, and like, staying stopped is like the issue here. Why can't I stay stopped? Like, what is it about me that I can't stay stopped? And I had to go through that pain and all of that agony and stuff like that. And with that, you know, working with my sponsor, Steve, he had a great way of telling the truth in the most harshest way possible. And he still does to this day. He's like, you catch him on a bad day, and like he'll admit, like, you know, I'm not happy all the time. Like, I pay the consequences of my actions. Don't learn from me. Go out and be more spiritual than me. And the lessons that he taught me, that like life was not perfect for him. And like, not only was he not drinking, not using, and not thinking about those things, is he was being a father. Our kids are the same age. And I took lessons from him, how to raise his son and how I'm going to raise my daughter. And I'd bring him over, or bring her over to his house, and they would play out in the yard. And, you know, we would talk about the craziness of life. But more importantly, we started setting time aside to go through what is in this book. And when I started going through the book, I started reading the lines, and like things started making a little bit more, it had a little bit more clarity, a little bit more weight with me. And like my experience with the power in step two is like, I just had to believe that like he's doing it. And like, if he's doing it and Jeff's doing it, like that power that he's telling me that I couldn't do this by myself, he couldn't do it by himself, but like together we can do it. That's all I needed to hear was, oh God, like him too. Like those words, always, no matter what story I told, no matter how I felt, no matter what's going on, you get around a bunch of people in AA that are living a spiritual program, the response usually is, yeah, me too, you know? And how important that was to hear those words, because I thought I was unique, I thought I was different, I thought that I went way down the scale, further than others, and like all this stuff. And really, in the big book, you know, they don't mention it so much about hitting bottom, but and then you hear all these different stories in AA, because we have all different personalities, we come up with all different slogans, we're flawed by nature. And if it's not in this book, I don't really do it. I don't really pay attention to it. That's just my take. It doesn't have to be for anyone else. But certain things that really confused the hell out of me was the don't drink and go to meetings. I did not. I was not successful with that slogan. And actually, things got a lot worse. And I see people doing it today. And that surrender that I had to go through, like, I can't give that to newcomers. Like, it's so personal. I had to have that experience myself to, and I really do believe that there's like two surrenders. There's one surrender that got me into rehab over and over and over again, got me back into AA over and over and over again. And then there's like the state of surrender, like that actual long-term feeling that, the rest of the steps basically have given me that. And that's the freedom that, like, I don't have to fight this thing anymore. And what an awesome feeling that is. So we start going through these steps, and I think it was probably right around step three, you know, like a month and a half in, 2 months in, where I started feeling a little bit better enough that, like, things came out of my mouth. Like, I don't feel like doing this, man. I really don't feel like doing this at all. And he's the type of guy, just like Jeff in our lineage, he'd say something along the lines of like, well, guess what? The steps don't give a shit how you feel, so you're doing it anyway. And my parents took my keys, my wallet, my phone, so like I'm here driving around with him, so I didn't really have a choice anyway, you know? And, you know, we did this third step prayer, which was, nothing magical. I had no idea what was going on, to be honest with you. I took the prayer, and then I was like, well, what's going to happen here? Because, like, I didn't do this before. It's like, am I good to go? And, like, this is a God thing, and, like, I have this now. You know, like, are you going to give it to me? Like, I don't understand. You know, I was just so in my head about life and escaping at that point still that I was so uncomfortable. You know, like, my personality now, my personality previous to, you know, alcohol, you know, I was always kind of the happy-go-lucky kid, and I was always the person to communicate obviously pretty well, and like I could talk to you, but then when this thing came over me where I didn't know what to do anymore, it left me so uncomfortable that like I was flipped all upside down, and like my strengths that I thought I had were now my weaknesses, and my weaknesses are still my weaknesses, so I really have nothing at all to really do. And I just was in this like mode of like not knowing how to proceed in life anymore. And then he would say something along the lines of like, welcome to the unmanageability piece, and welcome to AA. And that was awesome with the step four thing that's going on right now. That was pretty much one of the most important things outside helping another alcoholic for me to go through. You know, the writing of everything on paper. You know, and there were things that I wrote down, and I remember writing something down that I was never going to tell anybody, and then I cross it out, rip it up, then I write it down again, and then I went through this whole process in my head, like what the steps teach us, you know, that journey that we have to go on, things that we learn, the character defects, how we deal with them, and like what all those experiences. Like, I was like, I'm getting a different sponsor. Like, he knows me, and like, I don't know, you know. And I knew him from high school. Like, he was the crazy kid. And like, he's the type of kid that like, when I saw him, and he looked at me, and he knew who I was, and he just was like, oh my God, you must have messed up so bad to come into here. And I was like, yeah, man. Like, I did. And in high school, he was always the crazy kid. Like, I remember he was a great blow at me, and he's getting in fights everywhere. And you'd always hear on the intercom, Stephen Eastwood, please report to the office. I remember hearing that all the time. And so I went through this process of experiencing what it was like to be insecure, what it was like to have a full load of fear of what is he going to think, you know? And what we go through in step four, like, I know that if I didn't get rid of this and I didn't at least tell another human being this, this is going to kill me. And I'm more worried about what he feels than what he thinks. You know, and that's the process I go through in my head, the unmanageability piece, that, like, I couldn't do it myself. And luckily this program exists and the steps are in order for a reason, because I did write that something down. I did share that with him. And, you know, we cried. And I was never the same after coming out of a step five. Like, I just, the truth was right there. The truth was on paper. The truth was out. And it was like the first time in a long time that, like, there was nowhere to run anymore. Like, that's, the facts are right there. Like, there's no delusional thinking anymore. There's no, I can't like think my way out of this one. It's there. It's been said. And what a critical moment that was. And if I had to explain to you what was going on, we went down by the river, same place where I was at, same place where I was at, and I wanted to take my life. And I'm going into it, shaking, you know, I like got my notes ready, like I'm going to maybe skip over this one, I don't really know what's doing, how I'm going to feel about this, and we'll see how it goes in the moment. And the power of sponsorship is he went through that. You know, he had to go through that too. And we're down by the river, and, you know, got the lawn chairs out, it's a beautiful, beautiful day, canoes going down the river, and I'm trying to tell him about this fourth step, and I start explaining like how the book does, and he asked me, all right, let's go through the list, and like all right, let's, he's like, oh, go to the one that you probably didn't want to tell me first. Oh, okay. And I start telling him, and he has ADD severely, and he gets up from this chair, and he's taking rocks, and he's skipping it out to the water. And I'm behind him, like, almost sobbing in tears, like, oh, my God, yeah, this is going to happen. And, like, oh, my God, this is, I guess, how it affected me, and like all discombobulated, and he's skipping rocks, and then he turns around to me and he goes, "Dude, I'm giving you like 10% of my attention right now. Like, you know, like you're not that important, but like, you know." And for someone like me, he knew who I was, and he knew that I needed to be taken down a notch. That moment, God was there, and God was doing what he needed to do. And Steve was in the position. He took the responsibility. He took the actions. And he was the best person for the job with doing that. And then, you know, as sobriety goes on, you know, when I first went through 6 and 7, these character defects, I wrote down a lot of them. I think I wrote, and by a lot, I think I had 4 or 5, and I think there's 192 of them. You later find out that we all possess all of them. And in sobriety, as, you know, the days, the weeks, the months, the years go by, there's ones that lay dormant, there's ones that pop up all the time. And I had to re-experience in sobriety the pain and discomfort of wanting to change again, you know? And the character defects that were blocking me, you know, from this something that's supposedly inside myself. You know, in the big book it says that, you know, he's deep down inside of all of us. And what I took that as is this 6 and 7 constantly comes back up and like covers that up a little bit, just a little bit. And if I don't take care of it, it comes up a little bit more. And also I'm so disconnected that I no longer have that defense. So if I don't stay near to that, I'm dead in the water. And I've had the experience that that's the case. And with these character defects all the time, they could run rampant. Oh my God. Like, you know, they could hit you as soon as you wake up. They can hit you 5 minutes before you go to bed. Like, you can like be at work and having the best day ever. And like, they just get you. And part of the process that we get to live is the more I stay connected with the thing that resides inside myself, God, the spirit, spirituality, whatever you want to call it, then I don't really have to worry about that too much. That stuff ends up taking care of itself because now I'm aware. Now I'm aware of what's going on. So, you know, in these interactions and these things are happening, instead of me just like going down the deep end and then having to do an amends later, like I get to take a step back and be like, whoa, whoa, whoa. Like, what's going on? Like, why do I feel the way that I feel? And what's going on? And some of the most powerful things where God started to pop up and do things that I could not find explanation for anymore was repairing the damage of our past. Like I said, that internal demise that I had to go through, that despair, that desperation, more importantly, guilt, shame, and remorse. Oh. And then I found this process that we take these actions during the day, and then we're led to this item that's I've always wanted. I never wanted pain for somebody else. I never wanted to destroy somebody else. I never wanted to take peace and serenity away from anyone else. And here we are in a position to give that back to them. Like, through action. And here I have the opportunity to repair that damage with my sister, which what ended up unfolding is I stole her wedding ring. I pawned that. And she remembers it quite vividly because she put it on the sink where she always puts it, but I thought maybe she didn't remember putting it there that day, and maybe that thing was just my thing, and like that's just how it's going to be. And her husband, Scott, called me up and said, "Hey, did you take her ring?" I said, "No." No, I didn't. And he said, oh, all right, well, you know, I'm over here. Can you help me? Because, you know, I'm taking apart the sink, and I think it dropped down the drain. I said, oh, that's, yeah, I mean, that's probably what happened. And, you know, while he was out doing his thing with the sink, and he was busy doing that, like, I was busy doing what I needed to in the bathroom and taking more stuff. And my relationship with my sister today is, it's unbelievable. You know, not only did God come into my life and give her brother back, like, I get to participate in her kids' lives. Like, there were situations that she would call me. Now, I wasn't able to see them. You know, and now I'm in a position where she'll call me and say, hey, listen, you know, over last summer, she was like, I'm busy, Scott's away, can you come over and watch the kids for just like 2 hours? And I was like, yeah, I can. You know, I was so excited. So, shit, I get to give that back? Like, okay. You know, and clean the house up for a little. And then, you know, part of the other thing, too, is giving back to that, my parents who stuck by me through hell. And I don't know what that feels like yet. You know, I have a daughter. She's now 7. She exhibits many qualities that I do, and many. And I don't know what that feels like to have a child that you love so much that you can't do that thing for them to help them recover, and then leave the house and then stand there and be like, I don't know if my daughter's coming home. Like, I don't know what that feels like. I do know now that we don't have power to change anybody. I understand that fully now. But as a responsibility as a parent to keep them safe, I've, through the steps, been able to, for many, many, many years, my mom, when I was a child, would sing in the morning. She would be so happy. She'd be making breakfast. She would be doing all these things, cleaning. And like, and I remember getting dressed to go to, you know, grade school and high school and hearing her sing and just being like, oh my God, my mom's so happy. Like, that's pretty cool. And then there was a decade of crying every morning. You know, there was just that. And then the house that we're at now is my childhood home. And right before they moved out, I heard my mom sing again in the morning, and I was like, that's awesome. You know, that's so cool. And the same house that I was not welcome back into, that they said, basically, get the hell out, is now the home that I reside in and have taken over with my girlfriend. And that's pretty cool. But the main thing that I've, this process, these steps have been able to repair, it's not with me. Like I said before, like, yeah, it's great. Like, I get, you know, I get ease and comfort without having to take a drink. I have some peace and serenity in my life. I get to go to bed at night and not have to worry about the next day. For a very long time in my life, the worst part of my day was waking up in the morning. Like, that was the worst. When my mind would turn on and then it would say, oh my God, well, let's not really think about what we did yesterday, but like, full of fear of what happened, had to happen that day for me to get what I needed to get. Like, the removal of people out of my life. Like, that struggle of waking up every damn day of like, unbelievable anxiety and depression and like, all those things that's masked under the ism of alcoholism. And my parents get to sleep just fine now. You know, they know where their son's at. They know I was coming here. You know, they're part of my recovery. And to see them go from a relationship that I was destroying between both of them because they were at odds ends, to now my dad calling me to tell me, I love you, son. Your mom and I are down by the lake having some tea at our new house. Like, they don't have to worry about what I'm doing anymore. You know? And then comes the ultimate responsibility that we have, you know, to hand this thing to somebody else. And about 2 weeks ago, I spoke at my first sponsee's memorial service. You know, here's a kid that I was in a meeting with, and I'll tell the story real quick because it's, I think it's important, that I was at a meeting. It was a big meeting, kind of like this. I was sitting in the back. This kid, Dan, was sitting in front of me, and he was gone. He was off to the right. He was off to the left. He's dropping his phone. His chain's falling out. And, like, I remember him looking back at me with the googly eyes of, like, I'm, like, my type of guy. Like, this is awesome. You know, and he said, I'm sorry. And I'm like, dude, don't be sorry. Like, this is pretty cool. Like, you're here. And he kept doing that, and people started getting pissed around him. And I started looking at what we're doing and what we're a part of. And sometimes that's just the way it is. Some people, you know, I actually verbally heard the person, like, I can't believe he came here. I'm like, what? Like, this is where he's supposed to be. Like, you know, and he felt so uncomfortable that he got up and left the meeting. So then I'm sitting there, do I go get him? Like, what do I do? You know, like, and all I could hear is Goofy Jeff and Steve, like, get your ass out of the seat and go talk to him. Like, are you kidding me? Like, this is it. Like, go talk to him. And I went out to the parking lot, and I could hear the pills jingling around in his container that he had in his pocket, and, like, not thinking 1 second of that moment, like, oh my God, what you got? Like, how many does he have? He's probably too wasted. I'll take them off him, you know. And he was about to get in his car, and I took his keys, and I said, listen, man, where do you live? And he said, oh, it's about a mile down the road. I think it's to the left, and like that. And I said, well, why don't you give me the address, because I'll take care of this. And dropped him off at his house, and gave him my phone number. He texted me all night how he was going to take 5,000 Xanax and then, like, kill himself and all these things that we say to someone else for a cry for help. And then he dropped off the face of the earth. And then I was at a meeting sharing about my experience of step 4 and 5. And this guy came, and my sponsor was there, Steve, and he came to me after the meeting, and he said, hey, man, like, I heard what you said, and, like, that's what I need, man. Like, that, what you talked about is what I need, and can you help me? And I was like, I didn't know what to say. Luckily, my sponsor was there to say, he said, he's going to say yes, and that's what happened. And then we sat in Steve's car. Real quick story, Dan did not remember that exchange that happened before, because I told him, hey, man, like, we actually met before, you have my number in your phone already, and, you know, and he said, oh, really? Like, oh, when was that? And I'm like, I don't even remember. It's cool, man. Like, just, you know, call me tomorrow. And, like, I sat in the car with Steve that night at the hospital, Hunter Medical Center, where I spent many days in detox. And sitting in the parking lot, and I'm crying to Steve now. I'm getting tears in my eyes. And be like, holy God, I can't. Like, what the hell, man? Like, this guy asked me to help him. Like, are you kidding me? And, he said, God set that up. I don't have a part in this, and you don't have the power to change anyone anyway, so what are you getting all excited about? Like, you're just going to go through the book and tell him exactly how you got sober, and, like, the steps are there. That's the work. You're not the work. And I said, you know, deflation. You know? And Dan stayed with us for in and out of AA. I've driven him to many rehabs, dropped him off at airports, picked him up from airports. There was moments of time where we would sit together and we would talk about his family, and he would talk about suicide, he would talk about killing himself. I said, are you actually going to kill yourself? Because, like, I get that, but there's maybe something that we can do about that, and it's in the book here. That's why you asked me. And he would call me every day, and he would text me every day, and he said he's praying, he'd send me prayers. I'm going to be honest with you, I think he was doing it. I think he was doing what was in this book with the prayers, except when it got to step 4. Dan did not want to do a step 4. Dan got to that mark of actually having to go into actions. It's not called into feelings. It's not into any of that. It's into action. That's what we do. We do action. And, you know, I told Dan, you know, I can only do so much for you. I'm not your therapist. I'm certainly not someone here to listen to you complain about life all damn day. Like, I have been given the solution, which is in this book, and, like, you asked me to help you, and here's how I can help you. It's like, we're on step four, bud. Like, you've got to get going with it. And he stalled and he stalled. And then I'm a teacher. And I get a call from his mom, and she didn't even call the paramedics. Like, she called me, and she said, I think Dan is dead. And I said, all right, you know, I'll be over. And what happened was, is I was doing a 12-step call with him not too long ago, before that, and as I had Steve and my other buddy Pete take him outside, and I'm talking to the mom, and I'm telling the mom exactly what my dad told me. Your son is going to die. You are going to love him to death, and you are going to set this course of action. Like, you said that if he messed up again, he wasn't allowed in the house. You're letting him in the house. Like, you understand that. You know, like, you, I know you're thinking you're doing what's necessary, but, like, the kid, the, you know, let's, where's his pills at? You know, and I had him go get his pills, and we're counting his pills, and another crazy situation, right? Like, 10 don't fall into my lap type of deal, you know? And I'm saying, you know, there's a whole bottle missing, like this, that, and the other thing. And you know, when Dan died, being the first sponsee that you are asked to help, you go through this process of, again, was there something else that I could do? Was there something else that, like, I wasn't capable of doing that he might have needed, type of deal? And all I could hear is Steve's voice, you're not that powerful, buddy. Like, you're just not at all. And I had to go through that grieving process just like his parents. And I saw what the program offers is that new perspective that I got to witness what it is like as a family member of someone who's hurting so bad that that pain gets transferred onto them for the rest of their life. Because as much as I'm feeling like maybe I didn't do something right, that mom is feeling the same damn way of, did I not love my son enough? Did I not pay attention to him when he was a child? And she's going through all these 100 different things, you know, and it was so important for me because what was going on in my life and what I let Dan know and what I let all the new guys know is that this thing that we get to be responsible for, this thing that we never asked to have, is the greatest pain I've ever experienced in my entire life, is the foundation of my life now. Like, that ending process of wanting to kill myself is now how I live my life. Like, I thought that this was a disaster, but really, with the new perspective, it's like, that's the privilege that I get to have, you know? And that sparked new interest in life, many different things. You know, like I said, I'm not a morning person. I wasn't a morning person. You know, I hated the birds chirping in the morning. I didn't understand people mowing the lawn without having something, taking the trash out, picking the kids up, all the things. I was like, I can't do those things anymore. Like, now I'm waking up between 4:30 and 5 in the morning, not because I had to go to work. I don't have to be at work until like 7:15, 7:30. But what ended up happening was is I enjoyed the day so much that I started saying, well, maybe I'll take more of that. Maybe I'll wake up a little bit earlier. And then it's like, if I don't have at least 10, 15 minutes for myself, then I'm really not living, you know? So I started waking up early to give myself that time with God to just say, hey, listen, thanks for today. You know, screw the rest of the day's plans. God, I invite you into all my affairs today. It's you and me, bud. Like, whatever you got in store for me, I really don't care. Just use me as you see fit, you know? And that purpose that they talk about in the big book and that our whole purpose now, like, I have purpose in my life. That it's only to maximize myself to serve him the best that I possibly can. And those things that they talk about on page 52, you know, I'll tell you, when I was not drinking, not using, those things were be untrue for me. You know, prey to misery. I could not be of use to others. I couldn't hold employment. You know, I had personal relationships. It's like if I had five, that's better than one type of attitude. And that's Steve right now telling me, I love you. That's pretty cool. But here we are. You know, we have this entrusted power in us to go out and carry this message to whoever and wherever possible. And I take that pretty serious. And I'm not going to sit here and say that I wake up every day with rainbows and sunshine coming out my butt. And like, you know, like there are days where I do not feel like doing anything. Like I don't feel like doing AA. I don't feel like praying. And I don't feel like, you know, picking my daughter up. I don't feel like doing a million things. But like, I go back to these steps that were like, I didn't feel like doing them at all. And then it built this discipline into my life that says, whether I feel like doing things or not anymore, it doesn't really matter. They just need to get done. You know, and like I get to go to sleep at night in this situation where it's like I feel like I did the most that I possibly could that day. Like there's days where I wake up so early and then I'll go to bed a little bit later and it's like there wasn't another thing that I could pack in this day. You know? And that, to me, over time was so important to me to build that into my life, that feeling of life is not perfect, but like if I take these actions, it says it. Having had a spiritual awakening, like it doesn't say, like you hear people say it all the time, it doesn't say like maybe you'll have one, maybe you won't have one, but if you do these, there's a good chance you might have it. You know, it's having had a spiritual awakening. You do the steps, you have a spiritual awakening. You have that spiritual awakening, you get the freedom. You get the freedom to, like, not manage a trigger list all day and day. You get to walk wherever you want on this earth, as long as you're spiritually fit, to do whatever you want to do. And that's what I wanted my entire life, and I could not figure it out until I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, started coming to Feet First here, meeting Goofy Jeff, Steve Eastwood, and, you know, and I'm just happy that this program exists, and that's all I have. Thank you.
Okay, so we'd like to thank Sean.